Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Gary Lineker. Portrait of a football icon. England captain, World Cup hero, serial goal scorer, match of the day host, football icon. As a player and a pundit, Gary Lineker stands alone. He is controversial, but he speaks from the heart, in my honest opinion. I'm delighted to say that a biography has been written about him by Chris Evans, and Chris joins me live on the line now. Chris, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. And you are from Leicester, and for those who don't, you see, the thing is, Chris, people might think, you know, the younger generation might think he's just the guy in the crisp adverts and the football pundit.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is one of the main reasons we wanted to write the book, is that I think even some of the people who were around at the time of his playing career have perhaps forgotten some of the heights that he scaled because he's been on TV for so long. So kind of wanted to write the book to reveal, or, you know, take people down memory lane, or actually inform people of what Gary Lineker 1.0 was.
Because, you know, a prolific goal scorer. And I'm of that generation because I'm born 68. So when the World Cup came around in 86, England had been at the World Cup in 82 in Spain, but that had almost been a changing of the guard, in the way that some of the players were coming out of that sort of the 70s doldrums. And it was a new, if you like, World Cup. And Lineker, I mean, I just remember Lineker playing superbly. Did he get the golden boot in that World Cup?
He did, but it didn't necessarily start as brilliantly as that. I mean, there were a few questions about whether he was even going to stay in the team going into that third game against Poland, when he famously scored the hat trick and helped inspire England to get through. And obviously then he scored two against Paraguay, scored against Argentina, and came out with a golden boot. But he'd not scored for 5 or 6 games before that game against Poland. And I think he was, you talk about the 70s doldrums, I think there'd been a lot of players during that time and during the early and mid 80s, he'd scored a lot of goals domestically but hadn't replicated that for England, and there were a few questions whether that was going to happen to Gary as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting stuff. I mean, so for those who kind of think he sort of fell fully formed into the Match of the Day studio, I mean, so give me about Gary Lineker. Is he Leicester born and bred? Is he actually from Leicester? Is that where
he is? Yes, yeah.
And so yeah, talk me through the early years, because it's presumably Leicester is the first sort of, I was going to say Premier League club, but that didn't exist back then. So is Leicester the first big club, shall we say, he plays for?
Yeah. So, I mean, during the time that he was kind of breaking through during the 70s, there was no academy system like there was today. So he was playing for a little club called Elston Park on the outskirts of Leicester. And it was a junior side. And there's quite a few of those got picked up by Leicester. They got apprentice deals, but actually Gary wasn't one of the main stars. So to say he didn't fall into the Match of the Day studio, he didn't fall into professional football, he didn't fall into that Leicester City team, really. He had to work at it, and eventually kind of got his place, got a regular run in the team, and started scoring lots of goals. So he was at Leicester for a number of years, and then got the big move to Everton, and that was 12 months before that World Cup. You know, in 86, where he won the Golden Boot and the move to Barcelona. So it all kind of exploded for him. Nothing necessarily came easy. He had talent, but he perhaps wasn't the main man that everyone expected to be kind of England captain and nearly England record goal scorer.
Because this is the thing, isn't it? Because if you think about Lineker, we're not talking 25-yard screamers from outside the box when you think of Lineker. You're not talking about sort of mazy dribbling runs. You're not talking sort of like that God-given Gascoigne sort of talent. It's just being able to put the ball in the back of the net, and which he had an incredible knack of doing. They weren't spectacular, but at the end of the day, you know, an ugly win or a goal, you know, as it goes in the back of the net, it's still a goal. And so therefore that was his talent, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's incredibly smart. He'd worked it out even at a young age. Like, he played with a strike partner who was really big for him at this Elston Park side, and he used to just bigger than everyone else in their age group, used to strike all sorts of shots from all over the pitch, but he would ricochet off a defender, goalkeeper, off the post, and Lineker learned to read where that was going. And that's something that kind of, you know, carried out. You watch some of those England goals, he was stretching every sinew to be in that right place. And I think he'll tell you that you know, it wasn't about being in the right place at the right time. It was about being in the right place every time. So he was always there. And that was an art form in itself, that he knew where to be, where the ball was going to drop, and his best opportunity to score. And that was what he did so well. And I think, I mean, you say he didn't really score 25-yard screamers. I think for the vast majority of the hundreds of goals he scored, I think you probably count on two hands how many scored outside of the box.
But that's what, when people talk about a sporting intelligence as opposed to a natural talent, I mean, the big flashy ones, like I said, you know, your Ronaldos or whatever, are, you know, because they have the inbuilt talent to do that. You know, the Gascon again, I'll come to Gascon in a minute, but you know, as you said, Lineker worked on his game and he had that sporting intelligence, which all good footballers do. And that's what made him the striker that he was. So it's Leicester to Everton. And then it's the World Cup 86. And then he comes back. And so how does, because, okay, you know, you're playing okay football in the UK, in England, excuse me, Everton, you know, a great team. Where does the move to Barcelona pop up? Is this El Tel at his finest?
It was, yeah. But although, I mean, there was a lot of talk about Venables actually leaving before Lineker joined. But they did have a really good relationship. So Lineker had left Leicester and actually lived with his mum and dad right up until moving to Everton in 85. Moved to Merseyside, and Everton were obviously, you know, they were league champions going into it. They finished second that year. And lost in the FA Cup final. But there had been talk. Lineker scored 40 goals that season in all competitions, even though Everton didn't quite get their hands on any silverware. And there had been a little bit of talk towards the end of that season that Barcelona were looking at Lineker. But there'd also been talk that Howard Kendall may well be going over from Everton to be Barcelona manager. And there was a feeling that maybe Kendall was feathering his own nest and putting Lineker forward. The Kendall move obviously didn't happen. Venables stayed. And things seemed to go a little bit quieter on the Barcelona front. But then during the World Cup, they got in touch with his agent again and said, look, do you want to come over for a meeting and we'll see if there's something we can do? The myth is that it was that hat-trick against Poland that did it all and ignited Barcelona's interest. But that's not true. They were already sniffing around and a meeting was already in place. But between arranging the meeting and the meeting happening, that game did take place. A hat-trick was scored. Obviously, that didn't do him any harm whatsoever when it came to negotiations. And then there was sort of this feeling after that it was almost inevitable that he was going to end up at Barcelona. And Venables and Lineker were on TV together during the World Cup final in the BBC, had them both in the studio. And there was a sort of kind of uncomfortable flirting between the two of them. Lineker saying, I'll end up where I want to be that time. And Venables had that sort of glint in his eye. And eventually, yeah, the two came together. So it all kind of came about, but it wasn't perhaps in the same way that everyone thinks. You know, that Barcelona had a long-standing interest, or a longer-standing interest in Lineker than just simply that World Cup.
But the thing is, with any Spanish club, because Spanish football is different, Chris, I mean, completely. And Barcelona, Real Madrid are monsters, and they take players in and they eat them. And the team sheets are littered with those who came across to either Real Madrid or Barcelona, and the passion and the way they play and the expectation and the 24/7 media interest in the build up and the scrutiny, it can break some people. They can underperform. But Lineker, strangely enough, thrived. Is this because of his intelligence and he immersed himself in the culture and he really got what it was to be a player for Barcelona?
He did, and I think that's part of why he wanted to go to Barcelona. I mean, obviously there was all the football side of it, and you know, Everton couldn't play in Europe because of the Heysel ban of English clubs. But you know, I think Lineker as a person, he'd realised that he wanted to go and explore new cultures. And obviously the world is a lot smaller now than it was then. So a move to Barcelona was big, because it's not so easy that you can just pop to an airport and there's several flights home. You know, he was going over there and this was kind of like a voyage into the unknown. But he really embraced that. He learned Spanish. He wanted to make sure he was living in the heart of kind of Catalonian culture. And I think that's why really the fans took to him. I mean, he was at the same time, Mark Hughes was there at the same time as his strike partner. Venables brought him in too. And there was a feeling that while Hughes kind of did also try to get involved, it was Lineker who really kind of endeared himself to the fans a little bit more because of that. And he kind of flourished in that time. And Hughes, you know, lasted a year before being loaned out. And I think that's the difference, really. I mean, you see a lot of players at that time. I think there was a famous quote Ian Rush said, it's difficult because no one speaks English, right? But Lineker wasn't like that. He wanted to be part of that. If he was going to Barcelona, he wanted to be part of Barcelona.
Yeah, it was Rush also said, well, being at Juventus was like being in another country because it was. But yeah, I mean, he's still, you know, I mean, El Tal is obviously a god in Barcelona, as is Lineker. And then, of course, from that, I mean, Italia 90, the competition that turned the footballing world on its head, made national heroes out of people. I mean, it is kind of fairy tale stuff. It's high drama. Lineker's at the center of it. There's the Cameroon game. It starts slowly. I mean, Chris, explain how important that was on a footballing basis to Lineker, and obviously a young Gascoigne, and, you know, the whole Robson and whatever from there.
Well, I think, look, I mean, 86 is a massive thing for Lineker in terms of kind of his own status. But yeah, 1990 was much bigger because I think it helped a lot of British people fall back in love with football, because there was a huge issue going on. Obviously, the hooliganism in the 80s, England hadn't really performed particularly well. And, you know, actually going into that tournament, everyone was on Bobby Robson's back as well. And Lineker had this nice sort of way. And there's a great story that late Patrick Barclay told me. He was saying that, you know, because of the way the press had treated Robson, there was kind of like a silence. There was kind of a blackout that no England players would talk to the press for 24 hours. But even so, Lineker kind of had this cheeky grin and was on the back of a bus, kind of gave the thumb, gave the finger to the journalist with a cheeky smile. So they kind of knew that he was kind of bridging the gap in a way, in a very cheeky way. And that's what he was about. And I think that's what that team did. It kind of built the bonds, not just with the press in the way that it was. And, you know, I think Margaret Thatcher had called on them not even to be taken to the tournament because of the threat of violence. But actually, it completely turned in those few weeks in Italy. And while everyone talks about Gazza and his tears, and obviously that was a massive thing, Lineker was the man at the heart of all those biggest moments. I mean, Cameroon, they wouldn't have got through the quarterfinal if it hadn't been for Lineker. Scoring twice, you know, he won the penalties too. And the point, you know, that is how thin it was between, if England had lost to Cameroon in that quarterfinal, it would be just in the same way we talk about England losing to Iceland at the Euros. You know, it wouldn't have been, you know, epic failure. You know, they're playing really well. It would have been an absolute aberration. And, it, you know, arguably it's down to Lineker more than anybody else that wasn't the case.
And it sort of lays the foundations, isn't it, for the ultimate thing. I know Lineker's not involved, but 96 and Euro 96 and lad culture and just the whole situation it's been built on from 1990. Of course, 94, America don't even qualify, you know, and there's the whole thing with Lineker being taken off by as a substitute in his last game against Sweden. Was it Sweden, I think, the last game he played in? Was it against?
Yeah, Euro 92, yeah. It was. Graham Taylor as manager. And obviously, you know, I spoke to Alan Smith, who obviously played with Lineker at Leicester and was one of his, you know, most famous strike partners. But it was actually Smith who came on for Lineker in that game. And even Smith said, you know, it was a mistake. He goes, I couldn't believe it when Lineker's number came up, that he thought, well, you know, it's not a mistake bringing me on, but it's a mistake bringing Gary off, because he could always score a goal. And I think there was a sort of feeling that the not just the press, but, you know, the people of England were shocked that Lineker was disregarded in the way that he was, because he had been the man in 86, in 1990, that had just conjured something up out of nothing. There was a feeling that you should keep him on because he was the one who could score a goal. And obviously he was brought off. England didn't score. They conceded another one and they went home. And that was it for Lineker's career and England's Euro 92. So, yeah, it was a bit of a sad ending, really, in that way.
Yeah, but domestically, there's the Tottenham situation with Gascoigne, and is it the semi final that Gascoigne gets injured, badly injured, but you remember sort of like Lineker trying to have an influence over a still very young Gascoigne, because at that point when he gets the injury, if you had to say that's the moment that the rot sets in with Gascoigne and it begins to turn, it's that match against is it Forest they're playing, I think.
No, it's Forest in the final.
Okay.
In the semi was when Gazza scored against Arsenal and scored the free kick, the kind of arrow.
Yeah.
But Lineker actually scored two goals that day as well, but everyone still talks about Gazza, so he's kind of used to having Gazza kind of in his corner overshadowing some of those things. But yeah, it was Lineker. I think you can see the way that he deals with everything now still. He's very calm. He's very measured. He's got a brilliant way, and probably this is why he's such a great goal scorer, is that he has this brilliant way of kind of compartmentalizing things. So, you know, there's a chance missed, there's one of these big things happen, but it's happened, you move on. And I think that he was that for those Spurs players in that final. He, you know, this injury had happened and Gazza went, he'd been the talisman all the way through that run. And Lineker kind of thought, right, okay, I'm not going to let my chin drop. I'm not going to let my head drop. I'm not going to let everyone else do that. And he was pivotal in turning that around and winning that. And that was his only trophy that he won, or domestic trophy in England that he won. So it was a big moment for him as well, as much as it was for Tottenham.
And he goes into, you know, punditry. He doesn't become a manager. And again, you know, a TV studio is a vicious place to be. There are, again, it's littered with ex-footballers who try to be pundits and then, you know, didn't succeed. But Lineker absolutely not only sort of thrived, but became, if you like, it was like having your older brother explaining it to you and the sort of guy that you'd like to hang out with, and not speaking solely in football parlance. I mean, a tricky act to pull off, but he did indeed.
Well, this is the beauty of what Lineker's background did, because he wasn't in this sort of closeted academy world. He was a Leicester lad. He worked on the market with his dad and his brother and his granddad, and he kind of, you know, he grew up, as people did back then, he grew up part of, you know, society. And I think that's probably quite a key part in what he did. And he knows not to overcomplicate things. And he had this like nice reputation. He was always well-spoken, quite articulate. And I think that was really important for him. But he didn't want to be a pundit forever because he felt he could only say so much about, you know, being a striker. He didn't think he was in a position that he could comment on a goalkeeper or a defender. So he always had his eyes on the prize. But yeah, look, Match of the Day, that was where he started out as a pundit. But I think, again, it was very clever how they built him. Like, he was doing like golf commentary at one point. He went to the Barcelona Olympics in 92 as part of the BBC team. So he did all these things to build himself up. He was on They Think It's All Over, of course, as well. So that kind of brought out a little bit more of his character. And I think this was important in kind of building him to what he was. And so it then meant that when he finally kind of took on that Match of the Day role in the late 90s, he was ready and he could get away with those little quips and it could be cheeky as well. But you also knew he knew his stuff as well. And that's what kind of changed the role a little bit. So, yeah, I think it was a gradual development, much like it as a player, really. It didn't come you know, completely naturally to him. He had to learn his trade and make sure that he was good enough to take the City Match of the Day when it came available.
And then more recently, he's got, you know, goal scorer and the rest is football, and the podcast with Shearer and Rice. He's taken his crew with him, and that just goes to show how the BBC is scrabbling around now, but he is confident enough to actually inspire loyalty, because Rice wouldn't go on Match of the Day when he was suspended because of the comments that he made. It does show he's always been a smart cookie, if you will. And at the same time, if you remember his personal life, I mean, in the early days, his son George was very, and he got vile abuse, didn't he, for George's illness? And yet still didn't get your red card. He didn't get rattled. He didn't start, you know, effing up on social media. Not that it was around, but you see what I'm saying. He didn't go to the tabloids and go, you know, to the lot of you.
Oh yeah, he was very, very good, and he understood what his role, and he understood, you know, the George illness came while he was coming towards the end of his time at Tottenham, and he's still a player, but I think he could see, and his agent could see, what the possibilities were for him. So he knew at that time, and he was very restrained, and he knew to keep his counsel on things, because that was going to spoil his opportunities in the future. And he's very, you know, look, for all the laid back, you know, chilled. He's quite funny when he's on screen. You know, that demeanor, you know, don't be fooled that underneath there's someone with, you know, he's got something behind him, and he's fiercely ambitious, and he always knew how he was going to do that. And I think that it's a brilliant example of how to control that, I suppose, because he's not so much that he was a threat, but he was enough that people wanted to be, and they respected what he was doing, and they realized that this was a guy to be part of. And I think, you know, so many people I spoke to said how much they love Gary. Even if they're still not in contact with him, they said, you know, they really liked him. And I suppose that's a key part of it as well. If you can get people to like you along the way, then people are more likely to want to back you. They want to support you, or they want to kind of like get involved with, yeah, if you've got a podcast that you're going to do or anything like that, there's something there. You know, you follow a person, don't you, in the end of the day?
The book is called Gary Lineker, Portrait of a Football Icon. It's by Chris Evans, who is speaking today. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Chris, if people want to follow you online and find out more about what you're up to and more about the book, where's the best place to say nice things about you on social media?
You can find me on X at Chris Evans Write, write as in WRITE, like as a writer. Follow me on there.
The book is called Gary Lineker, Portrait of a Football Icon. It's by Chris Evans. Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
No worries. Thank you very much.